The title of my paper changed slightly, as always happens, but rearranged the same notions and concepts. So the title is "The Task of Philosophy Did to be Accomplished and Political Interpolation in Althusser's Reading of Machiavelli." In this paper, I want to discuss a theme that is central to Marxism and that has always haunted Marxism at almost every moment of its history, since the very beginning: the question of philosophy. Obviously, this is the problem posed by Marx's 11th thesis on Feuerbach, for which philosophers, quote, have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it, end quote. I will not go into a detailed discussion of the thesis itself or into the history complex history of the different interpretations that Marxists have proposed, both for reasons of time and, I will admit, also for lack of expertise. Less ambitiously, but perhaps as a useful point of departure for further inquiries, I will look instead at the way in which Althusser grappled with this question in a specific limited phase of his philosophical production. So the main goal of the paper is basically twofold. On the one hand, I want to argue that in the 70s, and in a certain unpublished and published partially writings, Althusser proposes a new definition of materialist philosophy, and that we call, following Althusser himself, philosophy of the deed to be accomplished, and that is distinct from other more famous definitions of Marxist philosophy, or materialist philosophy, that he himself put forth in his philosophical career. On the other hand, I aim to show that such a redefinition, such a new definition, paves the way for a reconsideration of Althusser's famous notion of interpolation, which is perhaps one of the most abiding lenses for Althusser, leading to what I will call political interpolation, which I take to be the specific contribution of philosophy, thus redefined, to the transformation of the world. Obviously, what is at stake here is the complex relationship on which Althusser worked all his life between knowledge in the double form of science and philosophy, or theory, and politics and ideology, a knot that underwent many displacements and that Althusser sought to clarify at virtually all steps of his philosophical production. It is common practice to distinguish between different phases of Althusser's thought following his definitions and redefinitions of philosophy. In the first moment, the beginning of the 60s, let's say, in the first moment of his intervention, marked by the struggle against empiricism and humanism, dialectical materialism was conceived under the aegis of Spinoza as theory of theoretical practices. Marxist philosophy, thus redefined, was concerned with establishing the concepts up to think of history and with effecting a break with ideology, an epistemological break. The object of knowledge was to be radically distinguished from the real object, as Spinoza, and the object of the science of history, the conjuncture, was to be known via the deployment of concepts such as overdetermination, displacement, condensation, and structural causality. Immediately after the publication of the works in which this definition of philosophy was proposed, however, Althusser opened the phase of self-criticism, which led him to a second Leninist definition of philosophy. Philosophy was not to be separated from politics. It was, on the contrary, to be understood as class struggle in theory. However, in his writings on Machiavelli and also on Rousseau during the 70s, writings that he would never publish in his lifetime, Althusser carries out a series of reflections on the problem of the relationship between philosophy, theory, and politics, which, while capitalizing on the idea that philosophy is, indeed, class struggle in theory, goes significantly, I think, beyond such a definition, to the extent that I'm inclined to consider it as an autonomous third definition of materialist philosophy that we can find in Althusser. In his readings of Machiavelli, Althusser suggests that Machiavelli inaugurates an entirely new mode of thinking, which he refers to, especially in some unpublished notes, as a philosophy of the deed to be accomplished, fait à accomplir in French, which could be translated as a fact to be accomplished or deed to be accomplished. Such a new mode of thinking is unique, not because it thinks the truth of politics, as opposed to the imagination of it, and this would be the standard way of Machiavelli as a realist, but for completely different reasons. The first one is that Machiavelli consciously thinks, I quote, the conditions of possibility of the existence of what did not yet exist, of the radical beginning, end quote. And that he thinks such a beginning as a deed to be accomplished. To be more precise, Althusser argues that Machiavelli's thought unfolds in the element of the deed to be accomplished. In Machiavelli's text, the deed to be accomplished is naturally the unification of Italy out of political fragmentation of the time. What strikes Althusser is that Machiavelli's analysis, especially in the prints, entails an entirely new position of thought before objectivity. From this perspective, in fact, the historical conjuncture under consideration is not a simple object, nor, I quote, the mere summary of its elements or enumeration of diverse circumstances, but their contradictory system which poses the political problem and designates its historical solution, ipso facto rendering it a political objective, a practical task. Therefore, the historical elements of a specific conjuncture are assessed as a relation of force, a texture of intermingled forces that appear as such only when traversed by the perspective of the deed to be accomplished. In this sense, there is a veritable dissolution of the object under the pressure, so to speak, of the objective in the sense of the aim, or in the sense of a goal. But the second reason is more important. What is crucial for Althusser is that Machiavelli thinks the deed to be accomplished as a radical beginning, as an absolute novelty, as the appearance of something completely new. In Machiavelli's text, notes Althusser, I quote, the problem of the prince is the problem of beginning. To the question that has forever haunted philosophy, and always will, with what should one begin, Machiavelli replies quite non-philosophically, but with thesis not lacking in philosophical resonance. One should begin with the beginning. But the beginning is ultimately nothing in Machiavelli. Not nothingness, which would be more Hegelian, but the void. Now, in what sense does Machiavelli start from the void? In the very precise sense that he, in The Prince, both asserts the necessity of a prince and rules out all the existing princes. This prince will have to start from nothing, and this means that he himself is a void, because his name is unknown. Simply, he does not exist yet. Secondly, because the beginning will be the result of a contingent encounter between this new prince and a propitious conjuncture, which is Althusser's way of reformulating the theme of fortune in Machiavelli. And this is why, crucially for Althusser, Machiavelli refrains from assigning a name to the prince and to locate geographically the place from which he would start. Here, says Althusser, I quote, we have the crucial point of this theory. In this void, quote again, politics appears in person in the form of a determinate absence. Now, this void or determinate absence is for Althusser, first of all, the recognition of the absolute limits of thinking. In a note, Althusser says, in fact, that the refusal to close the gap, leaving this void and part of Machiavelli, in thought, is the recognition of the necessary role of concrete and unpredictable invention of history. The recognition that solely the history of political practice can resolve this contradiction, close this gap, end quote. But this requirement, which certainly limits the pretenses of theory, it's a sort of materialist clause, recognizing the existence of an outside, which cannot be mastered by theory, brings to the fore the positive contribution of philosophy to the occurrence of a beginning, that is, to the transformation of the world. And this brings us closer to the problem posed by the 11th thesis on Feuerbach. Because if the gap needs to be left open, nonetheless, it has to be positive. its necessity has to be affirmed, and its form has to be specified. In Machiavelli, the form is the prince. Thus, the operation that is proper to a philosophy of the deed to be accomplished is for Althusser not the interpretation of the word, but the active designation of a void, a non-existent, that supplements the existing given, or the givenness of the given conjuncture, which Althusser refers to as the accomplished fact, as opposed to the fact to be accomplished. So the position of a new empty place that is necessary in order for the transformation of the present conjuncture to take place. It is at this point that the philosophy of the deed to be accomplished entails a reconsideration of the old Althusserian theme of interpolation. For Althusser, in fact, this empty place is meaningful only through its possible or requisite subject, says Althusser. That is, via the operation of interpolation that the position of an empty place entails. By positing a void, Machiavelli argues Althusser, I quote, practically, politically implicates and involves us. He interpolates us from a place that he summons us to occupy as potential, possible subjects, agents of a political possible political practice. This effect of captivation and interpolation, continues Althusser, is produced through by the shattering of the traditional theoretical text, by the sudden appearance of the political problem as a problem. End quote. Thus, the philosophy of the deed to be accomplished, practiced and exemplified by Machiavelli, ceases to be an interpretation of the word, to become a prescription or a designation of a new empty place that it summons us to occupy. Now, obviously, the use of the concept of interpolation is, I think, capital, but at the same time very problematic here. It is clear that here Althusser is not referring to interpolation or to the thesis of the interpolation for individuals as subjects in terms of a reproductive interpolation emitted by the ideological state apparatuses. Even less, he is speaking about a subject in negative terms as a wholly ideological concept, as he had done before. On the contrary, this subject is what is required in order to activate the political practice. This is, it seems to me, an eminently political interpolation in the sense that it has to do with becoming a subject of a possible revolutionary political practice. But clearly, the notion of interpolation poses problems here, especially because Althusser does not articulate this new use of interpolation with his theory of ideology. But if we bear in mind that for Althusser, individuals are always already subjects and ideologically constituted, then the occupation of a certain space, new empty place, on the part of the subject corresponds to the transformation from a subject into another subject on the part of the same individual. It is, in other words, a process of subjectivation, as what is at stake here is the passage from being a certain type of subject, historically determined, to another type of subject, that is, a political subject defined only by the task and by the deed to be accomplished. It is precisely this subjective moment of transformation that marks the difference between the prince and the communist manifesto, in the sense that for Althusser, the latter misses it completely, and therefore is not a philosophy of the deed to be accomplished in the Althusserian sense that I tried to elaborate on. In Marx and Engels' text, there is, in fact, no void, but rather the indexing of a presence, of a subject that is becoming the subject of history. Marx and Engels' text indexes the subject in presence and does not open up the conjuncture towards a void to be occupied. Whereas for Gramsci, the prince was a utopian manifesto and therefore ideological. For Althusser, it is instead the communist manifesto that is utopian and ideological in its suturing of history and politics, in the sense that the political agent is always already there and the subject is always already given. However, by stressing the moment of interpolation as the contribution of the philosophy of the deed to be accomplished to the break, change. I do not intend to suggest that Althusser is leaning here towards a voluntarism or subjectivism, as it has been suggested sometimes. The occupation of the empty space is not, in fact, the only condition of a beginning. The beginning is never only a matter of pure decision of occupying a certain subject position. It is always an encounter, by definition contingent, between a propitious conjuncture and a subject. In this sense, the beginning of a new state or extension or of a revolutionary process requires obviously both subjective and objective conditions. And Althusser stresses tirelessly that with Machiavelli, the irretrievable outside of philosophy, quote, the absolute limits beyond which it is not possible to master fortuna, end quote. But as far as history is concerned, the subjective conditions are always already part of the objective conditions. If a group of individuals decides to occupy the place of a possible political practice, they can well become an active force in the conjuncture itself. They can participate in the constitution of an objective propitious conjuncture. From this perspective, the margin of objective contingency, let's say, can be restricted. Yet, if Althusser stresses both sides, which remain unrelated, if you want, it is perhaps possible to read in this gap between these two sides, not totally thematized by him, not so much Althusser's failure to relate two points of view present in his reading of Machiavelli, but more so Althusser's idea of politics. Althusser repeats the almost tragic conception of history, which is Machiavelli's, in a sort of tragic revolutionary realism of the impossible, in which the possibility of making history is ever only partially in the hands of a certain specific group of men and women. It is in the decalage between the necessity of a new beginning and the absence of every guarantee whatsoever that Althusser, after Machiavelli, places politics and the task of philosophy. Thank you.
Up as well as down? No, only go down. Okay.
I'm holding.
No, it's fine then.
Okay, thank you, Stefania. Now we have Svenja Bromberg.
Okay, I might take us back to something that I guess within an Althusserian framework is very much taken for granted, but hopefully it's not too boring. This paper is born out of the convergence of three concerns that for a long time I kind of kept side by side, and it's really from within the work of this group that I managed to kind of bring them together. The first concern has to do with the kind of space of the group and the kind of forefronting of the problem of philosophy that caused me to make a rather naive assertion in one of the first meetings we had, where I kind of, as a response to a debate of the future and the kind of the status of philosophy today, I said something along the lines of, I don't care about philosophy itself, I just use whatever tools it provides me with. And in this first sense, I guess in that moment I took on the one hand the young Marx proclamation of exiting or finding the way out of philosophy too literally, namely understood it too simplistically, but also it had to do with, of course, it being difficult to disentangle a kind of commitment to philosophy as a discipline, which in that moment I was kind of negating, and philosophy as something else. So in one sense, the initial gesture my paper makes is to suggest that more than 150 years later, we might still want to return and confront the infamous 11th Feuerbach thesis. The philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it and ask what that precisely means for philosophy and how we can do philosophy after its Marxian end. Secondly, and contradictorily, I made this claim of I don't care about philosophy from within having worked for years, especially in my PhD, within French philosophy, more specifically post-Marxism and purely on the early Marx. So in another way, one might say that I've been always already been more invested in philosophy, even in Marxist, like Marxist early philosophy, than this initial reaction gives credit to. So it is also maybe a kind of a turn to self-criticism in that sense. But it is not so much that I'm kind of committed to working through any kind of subterranean commitments, but rather an acknowledgement that if we work within a kind of Marxist philosophical tradition, from Marx to Engels to Lenin to Althusser, maybe focusing on the French strand, to Badiou and Balibar, then the specific debates we engage with in relation to science, to nature, to the question of the renewing the materialist dialectic, contingency or communism, are all bound up more or less explicitly with determining the fate and status of philosophy after the Marxian proclamation of the death of at least idealist philosophy, or, and that is probably the question, or a more radical exit from philosophy full stop. And thereby, I think we need to ask the question or confront the question what it means to enter into either a kind of critical philosophy as opposed to idealist philosophy, or whether this exit is indeed meant as an exit into something else, into philosophies outside, whether that is practice in one sense or it is an entrance into science as Marx himself framed it in the 1859 preface. And then again, the question is science then history, or is it political economy, or a relation between the two? So this is not to kind of bring up questions that we've already answered, but it is more that I think the foregrounding of the problematic of the end allows us to see maybe impasses in attempts of renewing materialist philosophy that we have seen after Marx. And in this context, I recently worked on the question of whether Marx counts or doesn't count as an anti-philosopher in Badiou's universe of anti-philosophers and sophists, which kind of helped me. I'm not going into that here, but it helped me to pin down two complications that we might that we need to bear in mind. The first complication is that Marx's concern of reconfiguring the relationship between thought and being, or thought and the world, or as he calls it in his notes for his dissertation, the worldly sirens, is itself a fundamentally philosophical problem, which Badiou, for example, identifies under the heading of finding a new relation between concept and existence as the concern of 20th century French philosophy. Therefore, the specifically Marxist question here is not just to find a new relation between concept and existence, but it is whether this problem can itself be formulated other than only internally to philosophy. And B, the opening up of philosophy to its outside, or indeed maybe a flight forward out of philosophy, bears always the immediate danger, as I think we all know, of reducing, and we see it in Althusser, as Stefano, you just highlighted, reducing thought itself prematurely to its outside, whether that's politics or praxis, science, or something else. Then I have a third concern that kind of underlies this paper, which is that in the recent confrontations between historical materialism and new materialism, I think we can see a certain poverty or vagueness in the attempts to defend historical materialism, or indeed to assert a critique of new materialism on historical materialist or Marxist grounds. And I'm referring to texts that have been published by I'm only Choa, Tumino, Paul Ricrit, Susanna Leto, Jennifer Cotter, or Alberto Toscano, that, or indeed like 2016 Eagleton published his new book on materialism. So we have a kind of, I think, whilst very persuasive critiques of new materialism, the question of what the status and the relationship of philosophy is within these counters to new materialism remains very underdefined. So the main lines of the critiques of new materialism are that new materialism is inherently ontological, ahistorical, operates with bad abstractions, and is ultimately idealist because it believes in the power of transformation on the level of conceptualizing the primacy of matter, and from there and grounds a new relationality between different material, often also scientific and spiritual forms of life. And this is then often combined with a certain claim to unknowability tending towards mysticism, and what we can maybe also call an attempt within new materialism to re-enchant the late capitalist world without addressing the relation of these reconfigurations to a historical past on the one hand, and social transformation, material social transformation on the other. But the danger, I think, in these critiques is, I think there are two dangers. The first one is that we end up being none better than all the critical critics from the Holy Family. If we develop our critique itself merely in the domain of philosophy, so then we turn, it becomes merely criticism. Or, on the other hand, it seems that in order to ground our criticisms along those lines, we take recourse to a mix of very well-trodden definitions of historical materialism that we need to submit to a to kind of a renewal themselves. And those well-trodden definitions are then either affirming a historicized yet dialectical primacy of being over thought, i.e. the material conditions of social existence determining consciousness, that has, however, also famously been misused or reduced to the problem of science versus ideology or base versus superstructure. Or we do, and this is actually a position I took for a long time, and that we find, for example, Alberto Toscano's text is under this headline, namely taking Balibar's infamous assertion that Marxist materialism is indeed a materialism without matter, i.e. kind of taking the Feuerbach thesis and affirming that it is, in the end, a materialism based on material conditions of existence or the ensemble of social relations of production. So what we see here, I think, is are a few possibilities that can be drawn from this materialism without matter. Either it's a purely negative conception of materialism, where materialism is simply the opposite of idealism, which I think is what Balibar tends to do. Secondly, we can, and that would be kind of from work by Timpanaro on materialism, we can understand a kind of, on the one hand, ideology of the ruling class, and on the other hand, a materialism as the philosophy of revolution that can then demystify and counter the bourgeois ideology. The kind of a fourth option is to interpret this as having to return to a historical, and I quote from Susanna Leto's text here, to having to return to a historical interventionist praxeological understanding of materialism that I think is not very far away from asserting praxis in its immediacy against ontology. And or we have, and this is very interesting, in Alberto Toscano's text, that he actually starts from the materialism without matter, but does not remain with a purely negative definition, but turns to developing it as a materialism of social forms based on the work of abstraction. What we kind of see with all these ways of asserting a kind of Marxist materialism against new materialism is, I think, that that in the one hand there is a tendency to simplify or to indeed mold. So we have also a kind of return or a renewal of historical materialism that feels itself very close to new materialism and thus asserts a kind of multiplicity of practices in an open totality, or indeed asserts the importance of thinking contingency within historical necessity and thereby wants to multiply the very notion of materiality, so the materiality of discourses, the materiality of ideology, and so on and so on. And what I am mainly interested in to kind of look at by returning to Marx is to think a little bit more about this tension where on the one hand it seems we can renew a Marxist materialism by emptying it out Or, on the other hand, we can renew a Marxist materialism by embracing the work of the concept, so embracing a kind of ultimately very philosophical understanding of philosophy. And this is what then brings me to kind of not actually engage immediately in the critique of new materialism, but to suggest that if we return to working through Marx's own battle or struggle, or we might just say a detour through philosophy, we might be able to clarify some of these tensions. So Marx's discussion of philosophy, which I think sways radically between open hostility, implicit embrace, and direct attempts of renewal, is always two things at once and needs to be read as such. It is, first of all, radically conjunctural. So his critique of philosophy is always a specific critique of either Hegelian philosophy, German philosophy more generally, that then in the second step sometimes gets equated with philosophy tout court. And secondly, it is a systematic reading of philosophy, namely the kind of attempt to indeed ground a new materialism in a systematic conceptual way. And we have to bear in mind, and this is what I really take from Labika's work, and that I think he highlights really well, is that throughout Marx's engagement with philosophy, we see advances as well as regressions in nonlinear ways. So we can, for example, see an economic and an understanding of an advance in the understanding of political economy in the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts of 44 and 45, but that it simultaneously implies a philosophical regression from the position in 43, which was much more radical in terms of suggesting the rupture with all philosophy. So he kind of rehabilitates Feuerbach there for a specific purpose rather than continuing with this earlier announced break. And so Marx's initial worry to kind of go a little bit systematically through his critique of philosophy, Marx's initial worry from very early, from his letter to his father in 1837, is that philosophy's grasp of truth depends on configuring the relationship of the world of ideas and of the object itself, i.e. the real or the world or simply life, in such a way as to allow the rationality of the object to unfold on its own terms. And this is precisely what makes him very uneasy about Hegel, but which for him German idealism, specifically Kant and Fichte, and then later on Hegel becomes the primary culprit of this, are radically unable to do, to allow the object's own rationality to enter philosophical thought. And so this critique of the continuing primacy of the idea I can take many, many forms, and is not limited to Hegel. And I think that's interesting. Why it's interesting to look at Marx's relationship to Feuerbach and to Proudhon, because there you really see this oscillation in that, in the one sense, for example, in the Holy Family, it is really Feuerbach for Marx who opens up the passage from philosophy as speculation to grasping what he calls the depth of human misery, so a kind of path to a new materialism, against Hegel's equation of the bourgeois mode of production with reason that Marx had criticized in the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts. So we see in the Holy Family a kind of equation by Marx between, or a kind of coincidence that he notices between an appreciation for materialism in it kind of old French Enlightenment sort, i.e. linked to humanism, with the practical sense of materialism that Marx sees in French and English socialism. So a kind of linking between theory and practice, and very much in Feuerbach's materialism, the kind of turn against the kind of primacy of the rational to the sensual activity of man, and so the link between a renewal of the essence of man with practice. And yet, precisely this persistent dualism of theory and practice, and in Feuerbach, the thinking, practice, and human essence philosophically is the limit at which Marx has to leave Feuerbach behind. So it is not the content of Feuerbach's thought, but it's the mode, the philosophical mode that needs to be overcome. And similarly, whilst Proudhon is in one sense allows Marx to grasp the very problem of the bourgeois social form, namely the link between property and poverty, Marx's accusation of Proudhon in The Poverty of Philosophy is that he has a Hegelian critique of property and inequality that is in the end grounded in pure, I quote, pure, eternal, impersonal reason, which is not dependent on anything outside itself, i.e. formulated independently from any historically specific rationality of the world that produces the specific inequalities and property relations as private property relations. So this type of principled Hegelian reason has outside itself, I quote Marx, neither a base on which it can pose itself, nor an object to which it can oppose itself, nor a subject with which it can compose itself, end of quote. Instead, it is fully detached from the rationality of things themselves, from the objective and subjective relations, struggles, and consciousnesses that create and in turn might be able to alleviate inequality. Thus, whilst reason does move through the world with its dialectical method, it does not truly open itself up to being affected by the irrationality of it. The contradictions it deals with remain for Marx still internal to philosophy. So the problem Marx has with Feuerbach and Proudhon is not with the content of their resistance to Hegel or to political economy. It's not with how they relate to religion or to poverty or to principles of political economy, later on he will reformulate those, but I don't think that's the key problem. Nor is it that they don't make the theory-praxis link, but it is how they do that. Similarly, we can see that Marx himself remains kind of in these early texts, oscillatingly, of course, not kind of strictly, tied to some of those reified relations between concepts, namely the relationship between philosophy and praxis, or philosophy and the proletariat, or philosophy and history, then in the German ideology, or philosophy and political economy. So in Marx himself, we find precisely what he criticizes in Feuerbach and Proudhon as the ultimate limit of finding an exit from philosophy. And this is why, and now, I don't know, for those of you who I've maybe discussed with before, this is a big change in what I've said in my work on the Jewish question, on early Marx. I do actually think there is an epistemological break in Marx that we need to affirm, but I think it is not the break that Althusser proclaimed, or that which we take from Althusser, I think, is not the primary problematic here. Because I don't think it is a break between an old and a new philosophy, as Althusser writes in For Marx, when he introduces the idea that there is an epistemological break in 45. And it is not a break between humanism and anti-humanism either, because I think absolutely that humanism later on, after we've based our philosophy within a materialist principle, humanism can absolutely become a terrain of struggle that is not idealist through and through. But I think the epistemological break is between a speculative philosophy that marks an exit from philosophy as speculative philosophy, entering into a new definition of materialist conditions for philosophy. And I'm going to propose two conditions of philosophy, and then I will finish. I think the two conditions that allow us to think about the relationship between philosophy and the world after or with Marx is, on the one hand, to understand the world as conflictually constituted, i.e. constituted qua struggle and constituted by a real yet mystified, constituted by real but mystified bourgeois relations. So that would be the first condition for philosophy, and the second condition would be that philosophy has to allow the rationality of the object to unfold, i.e. a primacy of the world, which however, means nothing else than that reason is itself impure, so that reason is itself historically specific, particular, personal, and configured within struggle, however not reducible to the immediate, not reducible to realism or to sense or experience, because in order the first condition of the mystified bourgeois relations or the mystified capitalist bourgeois totality demands the work of the concept. And do I have 10 more seconds? Okay. And in that sense, there is a break with philosophy, but there is not a radical break between Marx's early and late works, because I think these principles of a kind of philosophy that is neither a speculative philosophy nor an unphilosophy, so it's nor a philosophy that is purely determined by reality, is what he has already formulated in his 1843 in the letters to Ruge. And it is, on the one hand, a kind of minimal role of philosophy that has to do with the notion of self-clarification of the struggles and wishes of the age, but not in its enlightenment formulation of that. And secondly, it has to do that with the idea of philosophy being a united effort, a task for the world and for us. And thirdly, that doesn't mean that there aren't moments where philosophy itself can become the terrain of struggle, which might look like idealism, but in the end is kind of, so this is kind of what he discusses with the role of philosophy in Germany, which I think we need to read conjuncturally, and yet we can read it conjuncturally in the way that philosophy can become a revolutionary sphere, but not transcendentally so, and not in a topological manner, as we, I think, find it in Althusser. So it's a kind of not a topological relationship between philosophy and its conditions, or between the relationship between philosophy and politics and history and political economy, but it is a kind of constitutive struggle over the kind of two principles or the doing philosophy under the two conditions of the mystified bourgeois totality and the impurity of reason. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Svenja. Finally, Maria can speak.
So my title is the same, I didn't change it, but during all the both interventions, I thought I want to say also something about my project in relation to the group. And also I want to say something on post-colonial and post-Soviet condition, because nobody really talked about it, but because we wanted to do two panels, so then we instead have only one. And this question is not really addressed, but for me this question is very important as another condition also for philosophy, or more generally speaking, that these two conditions, philosophy and the way we produce philosophy and the reasons why we produce philosophy. But first of all, this presentation, I will try to just discuss one fragment of my project, which has to deal with a broader question of revolution and epistemological break, which I look at this problem in two instances. First, methodologically, what kind of break revolution as such, as conditions on in the field of knowledge, first of all, and how revolution reconfigures knowledge and the way we act, the way we think, and the way we do. So this relation between revolution and rupture, I study specifically in relation to Soviet experience, and It's then you can already see that, of course, these two, it's double articulation of this question, even present in the title. So the materialist philosophy of history is both, I will try to show how the question of history and what is history then becomes after the revolution, and an epistemological approach is that, that I try to force and impose this epistemological framework to rethink, first of all, what is known as Soviet Marxism as a concept and as a, I would claim, a non-critical category, and I try to construct a new concept of Soviet Marxism. Secondly, I would like to say how this is relates to the necessity to do this work within this post-colonial and post-Soviet condition. And finally, I will just try to demonstrate how the history and the rupture, his revolutionary rupture with the past, with the bourgeois past, has been understood in after the revolution in the discussions between many different actors. Okay, so the post-Soviet and the post-colonial. So of course, first of all, in very empirical and simple sense, we have to acknowledge that we live under the post historical communism is over, or historical socialism, or really existed socialism is over. And there are also the colonial project, decolonization, and the process of decolonization also resulted in a reconfiguration of the world we actually inhabit. So this is very simply empirically that I think as a theorist or a philosopher, I situate myself within this condition. And I, of course, for me, the post-Soviet one is more immediately given because I came from that context. And since my early theoretical formation, of course, back to Russia, and then when I moved here, the main problem was how to relate to that past, how this past articulates itself within the present moment. What does it mean, again, this the second rupture after 89, of what kind of historical situation it constitutes. And secondly, of course, this work of considering these conditions was mainly done in the context of postcolonial theory and not so much work, I would say, was done in relation to post-Soviet condition, unless descriptive descriptive work or general description of these conditions in early 90s in relation to constitution of category of Eastern and Western Europe. So this kind of work has been done. In relation to post-colonial problematic and post-colonial theory, of course, we could see at least two main modalities of dealing with this condition. One would be the attitude which the theoretical attitude which recovers certain forgotten traditions and claims that these traditions now needs to be acknowledged because they've been buried under the grand narrative of Western capitalism or Western history. So the second is really linked that we read the history genealogically, and then we just criticize again. Of course, I'm oversimplifying, but I'm just saying that my project is something else because I try to. So I would say it's Foucauldian in form because I also try to recover certain traditions of early 20th century. I try to recover the forgotten voices and names, then I try to reconstruct the positivity of these traditions or texts. I do archival work, so I try to take I try to be in dialogue with that Foucauldian idea of how you could work with the historical materials. But then I try to the positivity of the very theoretical developments after the revolution is not only positivity per se as such, that you recover certain archives and this is what it is, and then you can judge what it is. What is important in this is linked, of course, to the Foucauldian form would be a communist in content. So the positivity of what I try to recover has to deal with problematization of multiple questions from the standpoint of communism. And now I will try to show why, what does it mean, and how this is how this happens. So I don't know whether I should say about the category of Eastern Marxism or Soviet Marxism, which is, as you know, a very problematic category constructed in both, you can say, before and after 1991. This dogmatic split on East and West determined conceptualization of Soviet Marxism. And very briefly, the dichotomy emerges in the days of Lenin and Communist International, when a new Soviet orthodoxy in Marxism was established as a canon in opposition of the bourgeois understanding of Marxism. So in these imaginary categories of East and West, of course, East would designate the Soviet, the revolutionary, and at the same time, the barbarity, the simplicity, the oversimplification. So all the negative categorization of East, or then Stalinism, and all the multiple negative categories. And West would be civilized European continent, enlightenment. It would be historical materialism. It would be the more positive way of doing philosophy. But then reversally, within the Soviet context, this opposition would be quite reversal, because the Western Marxism in the West would be a bourgeois philosophy, a capitalist society, so all these negative connotations, while on the side of the Soviet would be, of course, the enlightenment, the progress, and so on and so forth. But what I'm trying to say is that these categories, they up until now determine the way we understand what Eastern or Soviet. Eastern is bigger categorization, Soviet is more kind of compact categorization. So it still determines the way we kind of thinking about it. So on one side is also Engelsian, Stalinist, Diamat, all this, and then on the other side is creative, grounded on rich philosophical traditions. So, and unfortunately, this is how this categorization works until today. So instead of following this historically specific categorization, but non-critical and I would say ideological divide on these two, I guess today we can come with something slightly different, which would be based on rather idea of idea first of all of critical category, which would come down to the problematization of the fact that if we take constitution of Soviet Marxism in relation to revolution and the process of rupturing or breaking with the bourgeois past, then we could take the category of Soviet Marxism as any kind of effort in the post-revolutionary context to formulate or reformulate knowledge in Marxist terms. So Soviet Marxism is what tries to reformulate all existing knowledge in Marxist terms, and this is conditioned by the revolution. So there would be then distinguish with Western Marxism or whatever you would claim, not on the ground of Engels or Marx or Stalin or I don't know or democracy or whatever. It would be based on assumption that Soviet Marxism does not criticize capitalist society, does not offer us critique of capitalism. It abandons the critique of capitalism for the reason that there is no necessity to criticize capitalism under the condition of revolutionary rupture, which considers how to construct this new post-revolutionary positivity. So then what we have is return in Soviet Marxism to the pre-critical paradigm of thought, which would return to pre-critical, in Kantian sense, to pre-critical, which would ask, what is body, what is matter, what is, what is communism, but from Marxist standpoint. In this sense, it would be this strange oscillation between pre-critical and post-critical, in a sense that it abandons the Kantian paradigm of, so that, of course, it doesn't mean that, but it would, it doesn't mean that it doesn't have its own notion or idea of critique, but the fact is that it would try to constitute the positive ontology all the time, or the positive theory of this questioning in pre-critical sense, then arriving to new post-critical. And in relation to Sveni, I think it's also, for me, this project is interesting. That's why I'm saying this is Foucauldian in form and communist in conduct, precisely because this dialectics of pre-critical and post-critical, I think, could give us, and the constitution of these positive ontologies could give us very interesting ideas of even how we can reconsider all these ontological questions in this communist and critical manner when we regard new materialism or other movement which return to also pre-critical questions, pre-Kantian philosophy, but for completely different reasons. So then the rupture, the epistemological rupture in terms of knowledge and in terms of philosophy precisely happens because on the level of theory, and when I'm saying on the level of theory, of course it doesn't mean is that this is only the work of philosophers to exercise this pre-critical and post-critical kind of attitude. I think another interesting aspect of this situation in the post-revolutionary society is that it immediately establishes a kind of transdisciplinary framework where all fields of knowledge are subordinate to the task of this reformulation of knowledge in Marxist terms. So, and I'm talking here about political activities, art theory, then literature, philosophy, and many other fields. So all these fields, they work towards this task to reformulate knowledge in a Marxist sense. But then, what it would mean in terms of the question of beginning and rupture? Would it mean that there is some sort of axiomatic beginning imposed, that we begin with Marx, but Marx functions as just axiom, which we have to all the time relate ourselves to Marx, or imagine how a Marxist or a communist would answer, would articulate any kind of problem from what is body or what is relationship between sexes, or it could be all those problems that that the task would be for communists to formulate them in a communist way. But then does it mean that Marx becomes this empty axiom? And how does it function exactly? And then the question is also how this relates to the idea of the historical past. If there is this strong rupture and we take only the axiom of Marx, then how do we relate ourselves, how we situate, how we orient ourselves within the historical magma which constitutive to that rupture? So, of course, one way was to treating this question is acknowledging the kind of nihilist ethos of the revolutionary rupture, that it negates the entire history. It poses the pure, empty beginning with the axiom of Marx, then it degradates to something very dogmatic and unproductive. But if we look at historically specific debates around the question of rupture, we in fact find, I will try to briefly summarize them, two positions with regards to what is history and what is historical materialism, how we relate to the history of the bourgeois past. So one would be to claim, and it would be Leninist position and his clique, you can say, one way to relate it is the famously, we have to appropriate bourgeois culture and extract a kind of use value from the bourgeois culture so that instrumentally use all the achievements of bourgeois culture. And then it famously linked to actually a model of westernization, because, as you know, Lenin appropriates Taylorism. He always says how we use Taylorism in communist way, or all these questions would arise. Can we use this in communist way because we need to increase productivity? So this would be this kind of model of westernization, but then the history, in fact, functions as this instrument of instrumental use value somehow. The other position would be position of Proletkult group and position of Alexander Bogdanov, who says that, in fact, of course, we can't really... we can't really do that, because together with use value we extract bourgeois state. We will gradually arrive to something very negative, and we will abolish the communist content while we gradually will extracting and incorporating this history. So for him, the relation, the attitude to history of the past would be something close to attitude of Benjamin, in a sense that it should commemorate and should establish a relationship between all the laboring generations on Earth, so that there is the acknowledgement of generational coexistence and how this generation of labor contributed to what we have today. And this would practically mean... many things. It could mean...